Good morning, everybody. I guess over the last weeks we heard a lot about supernova and gamma ray burst theory and observations, but we heard only a little bit about the role of magnetic fields play in that processes. And our feeling is that it is somehow underestimated. From the energetical point of view, it's perhaps correct that because the magnetic energy is in almost all astrophysical settings negligible in comparison with gravitational energy or thermal energy or so on. But we know at least a few examples where in spite of the smallness of the magnetic energy, the field plays an important role and changes qualitatively everything we can observe, for example, from neutron stars. Matthias and me, we are now, since a year or so, interested to get a better idea about the role the magnetic field plays in the phases around the neutron star. That is means from the last phases of the supernova progenitor through the core collapse, the proto-neutron star phase, towards the freshly born young neutron star. All these phases are tightly connected with each other, and they are short in the sense that they don't forget about the initial conditions. So even at the end of each phase, there is some remembering to the initial state of this phase. And additionally, the final state of each phase defines the initial conditions for the next phase. So in here, we want to show you some recent results we obtained about the protoneutrons, the role of magnetic field in protoneutron star phase, and the role of the field in young neutron stars immediately after the finishing of the protoneutron star phase. To speak about the protoneutron star phase here should be only a short thing. We are motivated almost completely in part at least, we are motivated to do some research in that respect by phrases we heard or read in the literature, like Thompson and Duncan have shown that in a protoneutron star, dynamo magnetic fields of 10 to 15 Gauss can be produced. And we have seriously doubts on this reasoning. And therefore, we want only give some hints here, which perhaps trigger a further discussion with us also to clarify more this topic. Obviously, on the way between supernova progenitor to the neutron star, there must be amplification process for the magnetic field, otherwise one could not understand the observed field strengths. And of course, the idea is suggestive that we have a dynamo acting, because as we know from simulations on core collapse and protoneutron star simulations, there is a vigorous convection within the protoneutron star. The material is highly conducting, so the idea of a dynamo acting in the protoneutron star is quite reasonable. Moreover, we have now available velocity fields calculated in such simulations, both from Chris' group and from the Garching group. Of course, these velocity fields are calculated without the influence of magnetic field, but nevertheless, we got the idea to check whether such velocity fields are somehow dynamo-friendly. So we took results for these velocity fields obtained in the Yanka group years ago. Chris provided us also with such data. And what we have to solve to look whether it is dynamo-friendly is to look on the induction equation, which is a competition between the diffusive term and the convective term, whose strength is determined by the dimensionless form is determined by the magnetic Reynolds number. And what we immediately learn if we insert the numbers given by Kyle and what we know about conductivity and scale lengths in the protoneutron star is that we have an enormous large magnetic Reynolds number in the order of 10 to 19. That's a problem we are confronted with in practically all astrophysical settings, but in the case of the protoneutron star, it's not the large scale length, but the vigorous convective motion, which is a velocity which exceeds 10 to 8 centimeters per second. So, from the numerical point of view, one can solve such equations only for magnetic Reynolds number maximum 10 to 4, few 10 to 4. So we are bound to rescale this velocity, so we cannot get an answer how really the magnetic field evolves, but we can get an answer whether the flow geometry is able to drive a dynamo. And we determined a so-called critical dynamo, critical magnetic Reynolds number above which a dynamo should work. The outcome is that this critical Reynolds number is in the order of 10,000, just at the limits of the resolvability of this equation. So that means the flow pattern, which was provided by the people, is not extremely dynamo friendly, and it is.
Are you going to explain how you get this number of 5,000? Are you going to show more the critical Reynolds number?
Simply by solving this, we solved this equation and looking for the moment, always rescaling this number, looking for the moment when dB over dt is equal to zero.
Given
the velocity field, the geometry which was taken from the other groups.
You just do the magnetic Reynolds number as a free parameter.
Yeah.
And take the background fields given.
Yes. So we inserted a background field, which is it's a linear equation.
Do you think that actually has any meaning?
Excuse me?
Do you think that actually has any meaning?
Yes, of course. For example, in the Earth, you can also write down such an induction equation. The magnetic Reynolds number is in the order of 100. And we know in the Earth the dynamo works.
No, sorry, I guess what I'm asking is since the flow fields don't know about the magnetic field, you're not doing
it's a kinematic dynamo,
yeah.
Of course.
So that's why I'm wondering.
But when you say our flows even, do we even have enough resolution in our simulations? So when you say our flows are not dynamo friendly, is that our numerical flows are not dynamo friendly, or is it that?
It's a kinematic dynamo. So your velocity field is an input parameter. We take the velocity, your geometry of the velocity, and scale it mean velocity, and look when this generating term becomes overwhelming or becomes larger than what is the only strategy. So
you referred to the remark that the flow is not dynamo friendly, right?
Yeah.
And this is because the lowest critical Reynolds numbers known for dynamos are in the order of 10. That's why it's simply the argument to say that 10,000 is, from the geometrical point of view, not very dynamo friendly.
No, it should be larger than 1 because it is. So 10 is what is known from theory or from experiment. In the Earth we have 100, and here we have 1,000. So it means it's not so easy to excite a dynamo. Moreover, the real Reynolds numbers are much larger. So there are 15 orders of magnitudes in between, and it's no reason to be happy that they are so large. One could be happy and say, oh, since this term is very large, we will have a good working dynamo, but that's not true, because there exists in general no monotone relation between the growth rate of the magnetic field and the Reynolds number. Typical, one sees such a behavior that the growth rate of the magnetic field, so if you have an E to BT for the temporal behavior of the magnetic field, that it first grows with an increasing Reynolds number, it reaches a maximum, and then it goes down.
The real Reynolds number that you're quoting, you get that from looking at the actual velocity field?
This is downscaled in order to to solve this equation.
No, the real Reynolds number that you're
quoting. That is the real Reynolds number.
And where do you get that from?
if you insert a magnetic diffusivity into order 10 to minus 4 centimeters square per second, if you put in a kilometer or so, and a velocity of 10 to 8 centimeter per second, S comes out of this.
But it was not assumed, it's taken from simulation.
We took.
Not simply assumed, taken from this Kyle and Young simulation.
And did the diffusivity change in those conditions at all? The diffusivity taken to minus 12
is a pretty. It's a quite reasonable value. Of course, there is some dependency on the radial coordinate, but the electric conductivity is for that temperatures and density in the order of 10 to 24 per second. So and even if you change it by one order of magnitude, it's still, yeah.
How do you initialize the magnetic field?
We assume you can take any magnetic field because it's a linear. What you have to input is the symmetry of the magnetic field.
Right.
Whether it is symmetric with respect to the equatorial plane or anti-symmetric, and it should not be axisymmetric because the Cauling theorem forbids the maintenance of an axisymmetric magnetic field.
But how much can the critical Reynolds number change depending on the geometry of the magnetic field?
It will change the geometry, but note that if B dot is zero, then this is an eigenvalue problem with respect to Rm, and we did in fact determine the eigenfunction B. And the eigenfunction will change with Rm, it becomes over critical.
So the reason for this non-monotonous behavior, this is also meanwhile well understood, it is the flux expulsion of out of convective cells, which becomes the more important, the faster the convective velocity is. This flux expulsion is also seen now in very expensive dynamo experiments, for example, in Karlsruhe, people did such experiments. If you increase the convective velocity at a certain moment, the flux is expelled from this cell. So,
can you remind us what's the highest Reynolds number somebody's had an experiment for?
In experiment? No,
in the lab, yeah.
What was it?
Three different experiments. Some dozens.
Yeah. In the Earth is 100, so they are enormous overcritically. So to get only an idea, we have basically two dynamo scenarios. This is a fast dynamo where the growth rate follows the magnetic Reynolds number, but this fast dynamo is practically not realized in nature. Much more probable is that the slow dynamo is realized, where the dependence of the growth rate from the Reynolds number is such as I told just before, and we have to look for two possibilities in the proto-neutron star. Either the magnetic fields grow so slowly in comparison with the convection that the magnetic field has no will not come in the observable field strength, which we know from neutron stars, or then the dynamo doesn't work really effectively, or the magnetic field grows so fast that there is a back reaction you have to take into account onto the flow pattern, and the Lorentz force will change the velocity field periods in such a way that it's even counteracting for the field generation process. So much to this problem. Now let me return to the problem of MHD equilibria in young neutron stars, because the very existence of magnetars says us that there must be a process, there must be some neutron stars born with magnetic fields in the order of 10 to 15 Gauss. One cannot hardly imagine a process which acts now in a 10,000-year-old neutron star which produces from 10 to 12 to 10 to 15 Gauss. So the idea is quite reasonable to assume that at the beginning a neutron star has a magnetic field of 10 to 15 Gauss. We know further that only a small subset of all neutron stars are realized as magnetars, anomalous X-ray pulsars, and the soft gamma repeater. Here we have the connection to this program. And these magnetars are one of the few realizations in nature where the magnetic energy cannot be neglected in comparison with rotational and thermal energy. The magnetic energy is even the source of the gamma ray burst, is thought to be the source of the gamma ray burst in such soft gamma repeaters. And our question was, how does such a magnetic field in such a highly magnetized neutron star, how it is established? This question is practically the question, how stable is a magnetic field in a conducting sphere, in a fluid conducting sphere. This question was addressed already in Chandrasekhar's times by Prendergast, who found that there will be an equilibrium if the toroidal and the poloidal component of the magnetic field have approximately the same strength. Then there are a lot of papers by Taylor and co-workers in the 70s, which found that there is an instability which acts on toroidal magnetic fields, which is unstable with respect to large scale, n equal 1, that is the azimuthal wave number with respect to such large scale perturbations, and the typical growth time of this instability is in the order of the Alphane time. 10 years later, Pitts and Taylor found that perhaps rotation can stabilize such a configuration consisting of a toroidal field and a uniform poloidal field, but because they found other instabilities which just set in the moment where the stabilization acts, they concluded that rotation will not be able to stabilize, in general, a magnetic field. Now this, in 2005, this work is revitalized by Braithwaite and Spruit and Nordlund.
What does it mean it's not stable?
It decays. It means that the perturbation grows.
Does it become poloidal then? Because if it's very conductive, it cannot disappear. So from toroidal, does it become a poloidal field then?
Yeah,
it
depends. They differentiate between kink instabilities, so in that case a poloidal component is created, but they're also purely that it remains in a toroidal state.
But these are pure MHD instabilities.
Yeah.
So the answer is it does not
decay. It's ideal MHD.
You're changing topology, but you're not.
Yes,
yeah. That's what I was saying. So why is that important? Okay, I changed topology.
Toroidal field, you don't see stick out.
Poloidal, you see. Yes, it's correct. Yeah. The toroidal field is hidden in the But wait, you will see that it has some consequences. So they considered investigated the stability in AP stars and later on in magnetars, and they found that such a configuration, which consists of a approximately equally strong toroidal poloidal components, which a torus-like structure, so you have a toroidal field and intersected with a poloidal field, that may be stable in a situation where it is concentrated very deeply in the inner core, for example, of a magnetar. So she claims that can be stable, and we found that one should not forget to consider the effect of rotation, because if you think in the newborn neutron star, at the end of the protoneutron star phase, if it has really 10 to 15 Gauss surface magnetic field and rotates with a few milliseconds, then the rotational period is smaller than the Alphane time, so rotation should have some effect on MHD instability. And we, in our considerations, we try to consider how the rotation affects this stability. What means young? That means we consider magnetic field immediately after the protoneutron star phase, when the temperature is so high that the whole neutron star is still liquid. So the time to crystallize the crust or to have a phase transition into superfluidity is about about 1,000 seconds, and for Alphen times in the order of 0.01 or 0.1 seconds, there is ample time to have an instability working. So we take this results of Thompson and Duncan seriously and assume that the initial conditions for our study is the neutron star rotates very fast, 0.6, it's just the limit, to 16 milliseconds and has a high magnetic field. Some simplifying assumption are, of course, plugged in. We assume rigid rotation, which is perhaps not such a bad assumption, because the effect of magnetic turbulence increases the viscosity in the protoneutron star phase so dramatically that the rotation becomes uniform already during that phase. At the beginning of our phase, so there should be almost uniform rotation. Further, we assumed incompressibility, and that means that the flow velocity should be much smaller than the velocity of sound. This could be checked, of course, only a posteriori of our results. A quite weak, more weak assumption is that we assume constant density, but the bulk of the mode of the flow is concentrated within the core, which covers three quarters or so of the volume. To overcome this assumption, we plan to apply in the next study an anelastic approximation which takes density profiles into account. What are the typical timescales? The timescale of rotation, of course, I said already, is in the order of millisecond. The ohmic decay time is very, very large. Here we are confronted again with the problem of the extremely large Reynolds numbers, magnetic Reynolds numbers. The viscous dissipation time is smaller in the same order as the ohmic decay, time, and the Alphen time is in the order of 0.05 seconds for magnetar magnetic field strength. So we are in the comfortable situation that the Alphen time is much, much smaller than the ohmic decay time, and we can rescale down these magnetic Reynolds numbers so that the problem becomes numerically feasible, still being in the limit that the Alphen time is much larger than the ohmic decay time, so that we have, from that point of view, quasi stationary conditions for the ohmic decay. What are our initial conditions? We have to choose an initial magnetic field, and we took one which is really whose Lorentz force is a gradient. There exists exactly one magnetic field which fulfills this condition, and we took this as an initial condition. Here you see a meridional plane cut of such a structure, looks very symmetrically.
But it's constant density.
It is a constant density.
But you understand this. So you have pressure changing with it. But you have gravity in it, or not?
No.
But you will see it later on, that doesn't play any role.
But so for this configuration,
we have no stratification in the.
No, that's fine. So that's fine. But when you say magnetostatic, you solve the grav shaft.
Yes. You will see the equation.
That's the second one necessary. It's simpler. But wait until we see the equation, then it becomes clearer.
This is as our first initial condition, and the next initial condition we checked this assumption, this very old assumption of Flowers and Rudermann, who assumed a uniform field within the neutron star and made this comparison with this bear magnet where they discussed the stability of such field configurations. So we consider different models which are characterized by different angles between the magnetic field and the rotational axis, and for different rotational periods. I guess Matthias can continue.
Yeah, but to proceed with the induction equation, I think it works. Does it work well?
Yeah, it's fürs Aufzeichnen.
Ach, das Aufzeichnen.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, induction equation, nothing has to be commented on. Maybe the boundary condition, which is meaning that the jump, this bracket mean a jump, the jump of the magnetic field vector is zero on the surface of the domain. It is continuated into a vacuum field outside, which is indicated here. And the governing equation for the flow is the momentum equation, written here in a form where the pressure already had absorbed the centrifugal potential and the gravitational potential. This is possible if the, to write down in this form if the density is constant. So at the end you have only this one gradient containing hydrostatic pressure, gravitational potential, and centrifugal potential. And that's the reason why it is sufficient to ask for a magnetic field for which this term, curl, oh sorry, it must be curl, curl B cross B is a gradient. In this case, it is possible that this equation is fulfilled with the velocity equals zero. It is more difficult in the case of a stratification, of course. But it is still possible in this, in that case, if you assume that the stratification is not influenced by the magnetic fields, but simply given, then it is easy to create a quite similar magnetic field. Boundary condition is that the normal component should be zero because vacuum outside, of course, this is trivial. And another one, which is necessary too, meaning this is a deformation tensor of the velocity, meaning that the tangential components of the stress at the surface are zero. This condition deserves some comment. If you look onto the geometry, geometry is taken to be a sphere with a radius r star. And this provides a complication because, in fact, physically I should require that all components of the stress at the surface should be zero because there's nothing which could support any stress. But if I prescribe the spherical form, then I have already one condition in excess. So in fact, I can only require that two components of the stress are zero, and the third one, the radial component, is then deviating from zero. And this offers a small error, small because we are allowed to assume that the spherical form is not heavily changed by the magnetic fields. What are the parameters of this problem? There are inside the equation, there are two dimensionless numbers. The one is the magnetic Prandtl number, the ratio of two diffusivity, viscosity, and magnetic diffusivity. And the other one is a normalized angular velocity, here occurring in the Coriolis term. There's a third parameter, which is describing if the geometry of the magnetic field is already given, the strength of the field, and we express it in terms of a ratio QP of the rotation period to the Alfvén time of the Alfvén crossing time, to be more precise, of the initial magnetic field. The Alfvén crossing time, the time of Alfvén wave takes to cross the star in some sense, to cross from the center to the rim, or to cross around a perimeter, whatever. This makes a difference of one order of magnitude, so it has not to be precise so much. So these three parameters, in fact, should describe the solution. And I now come to some comments which allow to characterize the solutions more precisely. One should know that the system of equations allows for special solutions with a solution special symmetries, namely, which is one class which is briefly indicated by an S, where all the fields are symmetric, and another class which is indicated by an A, where the magnetic field is anti-symmetric and the two other fields are symmetric with respect to the equator. Another symmetry property is with respect to the to n axis, for the first consideration, some axis. And if one expands the fields with respect to this axis in the Fourier series in this form, where the azimuthal angle phi is then defined with respect to that axis, one can identify a special case, which is simply axisymmetry, where only the m equal zero term in this expansion occurs, and roughly all the other terms are non-axisymmetric. And of course, between these clear or pure symmetries, arbitrary mixed symmetries, field with arbitrary mixed symmetries are possible, and to characterize them in a quantitative way, we introduced these two quantities, parity. This refers to symmetry or antisymmetry or mixed symmetry with respect to the equatorial plane, which is defined that way, which simply means that the purely symmetric field has pi, capital pi equal 1, and the purely antisymmetric field has capital pi equal minus 1. And the non-axisymmetric parameter, I apologize for the cumbersome name, it is called M means 1 if the field is completely non-axisymmetric and 0 if it is completely axisymmetric. For the shown initial condition, which is this poloidal equilibrium, we have this pure symmetry of pi equal minus 1 and M equals 0. So it is an axisymmetric axisymmetric field, antisymmetric with respect to the equator. And what was shown was a cut through a meridional plane, which could be any meridional plane. That's for that reason. One further quantity will occur in the presentation of the results, which are called the ohmic reference energy. It means, with the symbol, it means simply if we set an initial condition and let it decay in one case magnetohydrodynamically with a full interaction of magnetic field and flow, and on the other hand purely ohmically, with the flow set to zero artificially, then we get in the second case this final energy, and we may compare it with the final energy in the first case and to assess by this measure the influence of the MHD back reaction or the MHD interaction of both fields. So this refers simply to the final energy when a purely ohmic decay is assumed. Now I come to some of the results. They are organized first by the inclination angle. It was already introduced. This is the angle between the magnetic axis and the rotation axis, which turns out to be a crucial parameter. The second parameter is this already introduced Q pi, which means the ratio between the rotation period and the affine time. So infinity means infinite rotation period, so this is not non-rotating. And this, for instance, this value in a proper denormalization means 6 milliseconds. Maybe you could give the parameters for it. Because I forgot to write down the denormalization quantities on the transparency. And if you first look onto the upper block, which has this inclination angle zero, the full alignment of rotation and magnetic field, and follow the change of this parameter, which simply means follow accelerating rotation from non-rotating to pretty fast rotating with 6 milliseconds period, then you see that this ratio, the final energy of the MHD case over the final energy of the purely ohmical case, to grow from very, very small values to a value close to 1. And on the other hand, you see that the ratio of the final kinetic and magnetic energies has the opposite tendency. It's in the non-rotating case, it's big. Kinetic energy is significantly bigger than the magnetic energy. But in the fast-rotating case, it is practically zero.
But that e-kinetic has rotation taken out. This is just just your velocity.
It's taken out. It's taken out, yeah. It's rigid rotation, so it was not included in this quantity.
Can you tell me again, is there a physical normalization for this QP or something? I just always multiply by 6 minutes.
It's in the physical. Maybe it's not well visible here. We took 10 to the 6 centimeters for the radius. 2 times 10 to the 14 gram per centimeter cube for the density, and 10 to the 15 gauss. And then it comes simply out that this number refers to 6 milliseconds. It's a matter of denormalization. So it's a bit tricky, but I hope you may believe me that this is true.
Okay.
For these quantities. If you take other quantities, then it may be different. But these are, in some sense, at least meaningful for a magnetar.
Well, I just wanted to say.
Yeah. Yeah, and here are this parity and non-axisymmetry parameters. You see again that there is a tendency to approach minus 1, which is just the parity for the initial condition, and to approach 0, which is again the non-axisymmetry of the initial condition, which means simply complete axisymmetry, so that the symmetry of this final field, in this case, is the same as for the initial case, initial field, whereas all the other slower rotating cases have a mixed symmetry. And this led us, but not only this results, but inspecting carefully the spectra and inspecting carefully the geometry of the final field of this process led us to the conclusion that in this fast rotating case of 6 millisecond period, the initial field which we chose, this is the poloidal equilibrium, and a second one, which is a Flowers-Riddleman homogeneous field, are both stabilized, completely stabilized by rotation. You may have doubts if you only would see only these numbers, but I think we could convince you if you show you more. It is completely stabilized, but it's not stabilized already for 60 milliseconds, and of course not for a non-rotating case. And if you're on the other hand,
For the very first one, how is that different for when you're not rotating? Is that the same that Sweden-Brathwaite did?
Not the same, because they have a slightly different geometry, they have a different initial field and so on.
Yeah, but then the final stable magnetic field, is it the same?
No, it's not. Because their stable magnetic field has as a necessary condition that it is concentrated in the inner part of the star and heavily concentrated.
And
it consists of the poloidal and the toroidal part.
But did they have stratification?
They had stratification, yes.
Okay, so that could be stratification, which you don't
know. It could be, but stratification is a thing which makes things more stable. We have the more unstable case under consideration.
No, I understand. It's really not the same calculation.
It's not the same, no.
But are you developing, toroidal field? Is that what the unmag is?
In what case?
In the non-rotating.
In the first one?
Yeah,
yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you compare angles for the same rotation rate, let us focus onto the fast rotation, which is most interesting maybe, then you see that with increasing inclination angle, the stabilization effect is more and more destroyed. You may speak about stabilization in this case, and if you look into the geometry, it looks a bit like, but in fact, it's not a complete stabilization already for 45 degrees, and it's not at all a stabilization for 90 degrees. So there should be a range of angles between zero and somewhere below 45, for which stabilization is possible for the 6 millisecond period, but all bigger angles would be not lead to a stabilized situation.
Is this also a problem if you had smaller magnetic fields?
Pardon?
If you had like a pulsar, pulsar.
A pulsar.
Like a radio pulsar.
Yeah. I hope to.
With this angle dependence, that'd be awesome.
I intended to address that in the conclusions, but I may say it now, that if you have a two or even three orders of magnitude smaller field, then any angle is stabilized. So there is no discrimination between angles for standard Pauser field, but there is a discrimination for Magnetar fields, the selection effect. Yeah. Because that's why the Alfvén times becomes big then. Mm-hmm. And this shows some energies of this process in an unstable case. It is not a non-rotating case, but this is a slowly rotating case, 600 milliseconds even. And you see here, if you look into the magnetic energy, the total magnetic energy, these are poloidal and toroidal parts. Of course, the initial condition is poloidal, that's why we start here and here with the zero. And you see the three phases, where first you have a phase which can be identified with a linear stage of the process, where you have a simple ohmic decay. See, of course, in nature, the ohmic decay is not that fast, like here. But for numerical reasons, we had to enhance the ohmic decay a lot. Nevertheless, we think the results remain valid with respect to stability or non-stability or instability. The second stage is then characterized by a quick destruction of the large scale, of the magnetic energy in the sense that it is in parts transferred to the kinetic energy and in other parts dissipated. And then a final phase of a slow development where again the ohmic decay takes over.
And here you have the corresponding energies for the flow, the kinetic energies, and you see here corresponding to this very steep decrease of kinetic energy, a peak of the kinetic energy, which takes energy out from the field and consumes it then by viscosity.
What are you doing?
Pardon?
What is the time scale?
The time scale is, wait a moment, this 0.01 means one alpha in time. This is one alpha in time.
That is how long?
This is 0.05 seconds.
What's the viscosity?
So it doesn't enter. Because we are on the dimensionless stage, but when denormalizing, it is the same like the diffusivity, and the diffusivity is?
Approximately the same. The diffusivity is 10 to minus 4.
10 to the minus 4. The viscosity is the same, because we had Prandtl number 1. Yeah, and more clearly even, one can see the occurrence of an instability if looking onto the spectra here. Each of these curves, the individual curves, don't matter. That's why I plotted them all into one picture. The individual curves correspond to one M constituent. I showed this Fourier expansion of the fields, where the index M refers to different modes with respect to the azimuth, and each of these curves refers to one of this M. And that's why here this magnetic energy with the index M. And what you see is a behavior where first some feeding occurs from the initial condition. The energy is distributed along all the modes. And then here, approximately here, you can identify a linear stage. It's really possible to do that in detail. And one sees that the growth is exponentially here. And the same is true for the kinetic energy modes with respect to M. So that there is clearly a linear stage characterized by growth rates, where it turns out that high M have high growth rates, like predicted in the analytical work of Taylor and others. And another indication is given by the temporal behavior of the parities, or it should be pi here, excuse me, where you see that the magnetic parity, for instance, starts at somewhere at minus 1, but doesn't go back to minus 1 as it should in the stable case, and the kinetic energy approaches almost 1, and something similar could be discussed with respect to the non-axis symmetries. These are the zooms. In contrast, a fast rotating case, 6 milliseconds, which is, as I already said, is stabilized. You see the following temporal behavior of the energies. The overall energy is behaving almost completely like in the ohmic decay. You already saw that the final energy ratio is almost 1, so this is practically the ohmic decay, and this is supported by the fact that all the other energies, the kinetic poloidal, kinetic toroidal, and magnetic toroidal energies have amplitudes maxima around some dozens here, whereas the total energy is 2 times 10 to the 6. So this makes another point to see that there is stabilization, and the same can be done, concluded from this M spectra, where you see for all these individual curves which refer to a single M, except apart from a feeding phase here at the beginning, you see this exponentially decaying behavior here in this area for the magnetic modes and for the kinetic modes. So this should be really stable case. Yeah. Zooms. Now it's time to come to the conclusions. We may say that for neutron stars which are born with this canonical magnetar strength of 10 to the 15 Gauss or more, there is a discrimination with respect to rotation rate and angle. If the rotation rate is somewhere in this area below 5 or 6 milliseconds, maybe a bit higher, and somewhere in this area below 45 degrees, then the field will be stabilized, and at the end there will still be a strong field which later on forms what observers call a magnetar. And if not, if one of these conditions is violated, then they will turn to standard pulsars because the magnetic field is consumed somehow. In our calculations, it is really dissipated, but in nature it would be transformed to kinetic energies and parts, or into the energy of small-scale magnetic fields, which no longer give rise for an observable field, at least not for an observable large-scale field. And we further conclude that with some certainty, no other stabilizing effect like the torus-like configuration of Braithwaite and Sproyd, which do exist, we know that, but they have the drawback that they are heavily concentrated in the core, that with what means in detail they have a decrease between core and surface of the star by three orders of magnitude. And moreover, to settle up to this specific configuration from a more or less arbitrary initial condition, they lose again about one order of magnitude in strength. This is shown by Braithwaite and Sproyd. So that at the end, to come to 10 to the 15 Gauss at the surface, one had to have 10 to the 18 Gauss at the beginning, at the initial stage, and in the center of the star. And that's a bit much. And that's why we have doubts that this torus-like configuration is really an option for magnetars. And the other thing is density stratification. It really was done by Braithwaite and Sproyd simulation. They took it into account, and they nevertheless saw no possibility to get a stable final state except this one. This was the only one they got, this heavily concentrated inner field, which offers the complication that you must assume something around 10 to the 18 Gauss at the beginning of the neutron star phase. That's why a premature, but we would tend to say only rapid rotation can maintain a magnetar field. And what I already said is that normal neutron stars with this somewhere around this canonical pulsar field strength and with rotation periods in a broad range will be always stabilized so that there is no selection effect for the angles. This selection effect occurs only for magnetars, or for fields which are much stronger than this. Yeah. These were the conclusions. If you like, I could show you a movie which demonstrates the unstable process, because the stable process is not very meaningful for a movie. So I refrain from creating a movie. But I can show you the unstable case. The movies correspond to the unstable case I showed here with a really slowly rotating star. And not realistic for a neutron star, in fact. And I first show the normal component of the magnetic field on the surface of the star. This is the surface, should be, yeah, it's longitude and latitude. And the grayscale indicates the normal component. Light means out of the star, black means into the star. As a comment, I should say that the initial perturbation, which then evolves unstably, is in some sense arbitrary. So don't think too much about the specific geometry you see then. Okay. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work like I wanted. You see at the beginning of the linear stage, which has some dependency on longitude, goes with m equals 6 or 7. This is simply due to the arbitrary initial condition. You could have put something else. But as nobody knows about the initial condition for the perturbation, so it's as well as another choice. What is really seen is that the dipolar structure of the field is completely destroyed, and you have something more or less small-scaled in the intermediate stage, and at the end, again, something large-scaled, what you see here. But note that this is due, for sure, due to the influence of the heavily enhanced dissipation in this simulation, which are, of course, not the realistic ones. Okay. and the other movie shows the same case, but in a meridional plane. Upper panel is magnetic field and lower panel is velocity. starts with this more or less homogeneous field inside, which is this poloidal equilibrium, and ends up with something which has no clear symmetry anymore. Yeah, that's it.
So this means then that the magnetons must have rotated very rapidly when they were born.
Now you have an additional small information. And yeah. Having in mind that there are very few magnetons.
But there are not few. Yeah. I mean, you must look at the birth rate. And if you look at the numbers which you see, and also the lifetime, the spin down time scale, then you get to something at least 20% of what the old neutrons started from.
Yeah.
So it's not few, quite a lot of them, but you see only a few of them because they die out so quick.
So the issue here is that Chris Thompson also believes that you need the faster spinning one to make the hydrogen neutrons in the first place, but that tells you there's a lot of fast spinning neutron stars, and I'll tell you something right now, the stellar evolution people do not make 5 millisecond neutron stars anymore. So right now,
because they decided they didn't like rotation, so they flipped a parameter, and all of their simulations right now produce 7 millisecond or slower neutron stars. So right now they predict no magnetars if this constraint is real.
What they could do is the parameters.
Well, it's the viscosity in the star.
Wow.
And it's magnetic.
You mean
field
that the core field does not?
Yeah, the core does not rotate because it's magnetic fields in the star's evolution. But right now their fastest is 7 milliseconds.
So what is the reason that neutron stars are born with these high fields greater than 10 to the 15?
You can imagine, of course, that the dynamo process works. You can imagine simply flux conservation during collapse. If you have, as the star evolution people calculate in the latest phase of the supernova progenitor, you have, say, calculate magnetic fields in the order of 10 to 9 toroidal fields, 5 times 10 to 9, 10 to 6 poloidal fields using the Struid dynamo.
Yeah,
so then you can, if you amplify it by flux conservation, you are easily at 10 to 15.
If you think flux conservation, then you should have even more than you see, in a sense. I mean, why are there so much disparity? And why are most neutron stars, and, you know, if you said 20% of magnetar, that means 80% are born with fields.
I think it's a lower limit, lower 20%. Could
no,
be
but
more.
I'm saying it's not all. I mean, so flux conservation is certainly not the idea for.
But that's their point. Is that their point is that.
And you have selection after.
Yeah, they no. Die out. You lose your poloidal field if you. Unless they're aligned with
it was a large scale field, yeah, at least.
So what basically then is that the initial conditions make such a big difference to what you're going to get essentially, and this all comes out from stellar evolution calculations, which we don't really know.
Now, it comes with respect to the magnetic field. It may come out very significantly from the proto-neutron star phase, which you don't know again exactly. But it is what we try to advocate. Is that this phase should be very seriously investigated or reinvestigated with respect to magnetic field generation, which requires to investigate the study before the convection again.
Now, I guess my question sort of was more than in the case of, can you explain the distribution of the magnetic fields from, you know, from all these processes? Like if you say flux conservation, you should probably get almost all of them. They almost all have the similar radius and stuff, so you should probably get almost all of them to be similar. So can you explain this distribution from 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 15,000?
Among the A among the B stars, you have the peculiar ones, which is something 10-20%, which have these large magnetic fields, like a few thousand gauss. But the biggest one is Babcock star, is certain 5,000 gauss over the whole surface. And that star probably has a radius of something like 3 or 4 times the radius of the sun. So if you just collapse it to a neutron star,
okay,
you amplify the field by, well, the radius goes down by more than a factor 10 to the 5, so you the surface area 10 to the 10, and then if you have already 35,000 Gauss, you get close to 10 to the 15. Yeah. So right. Flux concentration is not really a problem.
It's a B3 star,
so it could be 7 or 8 solar masses.
Usually those are mentioned for the magnetic white dwarfs, right?
Well, this is a transition.
We don't know about the earlier types. We really don't know because the spectral lines are not sharp.
But are there enough of them to account for the number of magnetars that we?
Well, if you would say that maybe this large field go on also among the earlier types, which nobody really can detect, then you would have 10-20% of them. Yeah, you could do it.
Basically, the fields, there's a distribution in the stars themselves, and then you get conservation all throughout the thing, and you get the same distribution in the neutron stars. That's essentially.
Yeah, but that's the simplest. But I think actually, when the whole thing is collapsing and then it's rotating, you'll get differential rotation. You wind up field lines, and you get a very large toroidal field, I think, which at some point will go back to toroidal, I presume, because of toroidal are unstable.
But this is just part of our work.
So you could wind up to very large field strengths. But the dynamo action during the collapse could create very large
fields. Okay. I have a question. What does happen with those whose p is greater than 10 milliseconds and alpha is greater? What happens to those objects?
The simulation doesn't nature, because the simulations did contain too much dissipation. But in nature, I would guess that the magnetic field energy is transformed to small strip magnetic field constituents and to kinetic energy of flow, which could be more or less small scale. The proper energy is not lost, but is transferred to a place where, to a form where it's no longer well observable, because a large scale field is missing. You will, at the end, may have small scale field with a big energy, but not a dipolar one. It's a strong dipolar.
Yeah, so there are some constraints, especially with cyclotron lines, which come closer to the surface. So you can't hide them in multiple fields, Pardon me?
This is not excluded. But the magnetar idea relies on the fact that there is a heavy dipolar radiation in the early phase. And this is only possible if you have a philosophy of field, a dipolar or quadrupolar field.
Supposing if the ordinary pulsars, which would be your line number two, as you said, they could become standard pulsars. The one expectation of your model is that standard pulsars, they may have a dipole field which is not 10 to 15 Gauss, because you arrange the field so it's mainly multipolar, but if you go close to the surface, eventually you must see this 10 to 15 Gauss.
Maybe?
Well, no. If you're not dissipating, it's not going to go anywhere. Yeah. It becomes very tiny fields.
It's possible, yeah.
Positive, negative, north-south. So if I go very close, I should see it. And okay, you can make it multipolar with whatever that number, 1,000, which sounds extreme.
Also, smaller scale makes dissipation faster.
But this maybe for a few thousand years, not that important. You're right.
Well, I don't know. I thought the dissipation time scales are always so small on the scale of which, even if I make it if I make it multiple, it never has, as to my knowledge, that never helps.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. So all I'm saying is, so there is some constraint that for some objects we have actual cyclotron lines, and they're not measured in the light cylinder way. They're measured closer.
Okay.
And of course, maybe they're not a part of this story. I'm just saying, don't forget that there are some observational tests as people get more clever. And maybe you could, in fact, go to the other extreme and say, whenever you don't see any indication of cyclotron line, that's because it's so high a magnetic field that that's why you're not seeing it.
They are then in the very high energy X-ray, of which we cannot really detect. Because you take the 12 Gauss, they give the cyclotron lines, so where are the
10 kV.
In the parametrical electrons, it follows the
10 kV.
So let me just be sure I understand the physics. So, it looks to me like it's if I just wrote down the momentum equation, I would see that at rapid rotation, the Coriolis force is stabilizing compared to the magnetic, compared to the Lorentz force.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's a critical, in your case, P or whatever, this critical ratio, which is basically that ratio. And so if I'm rotating rapidly, I stabilize. And I'm linearly stable, right? If you put a perturbation on those models, it goes back to initial state.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so that you can just write down analytically, right? So that's not a surprise. That's just linear stability.
It is a surprise because it was done analytically by Pitts and Taylor in 85, and they found a stabilizing effect of rotation.
Yeah.
But at the same point where the stabilizing effect seizes the usual Taylor instability or peak instability, another instability occurs on the analysis, which makes the things again unstable. And it's practically the same point on the axis of omega of periods. So they concluded that due to this effect, rotation probably will not stabilize. And something similar was observed by a separation of carrying footlets. We again found such a disappearing of one instability and appearance of another one at the same point.
So was the other instability as possible?
Yeah, physically or
something that would be resolved by your model? That's
right. It should be resolved, of course.
Okay,
except for the case that this ties to the static equation. Then we couldn't resolve it.
So they can't tell in their analytics, they can tell if it's stratification.
In the analytic calculation, they took into account stratification. And we did not. Uh-huh. So if this second instability is bound to stratification, we couldn't observe it. That's true.
But there was no fault. When you go linearly unstable, then you develop large flows, and because they have a finite viscosity, those flows just dissipate. Right, so you're taking magnetic energy into kinetic energy, which then gets dissipated because they have a finite viscosity, right? Okay.
Yeah. And then maybe.
Yeah, that's why. I'm just trying to understand. I mean, you had to put in a finite viscosity, otherwise it would just, your simulation never would have ended. It would have just been oscillating forever.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
If one, if you look onto this. To this picture, you may take the simulation seriously. You may believe them, say up to this point.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's just still in kinematics.
Right? After that, the dissipation takes over. Yeah. Sorry, there's something. Something is.
I don't know what.
Okay.